That this morning. I just want to give you an orientation to what we're going to be doing today. Although this gathering is really an idea of Senator Claussen's. He came to me towards the end of the session and said, you know what would really be nice is if there was some kind of an orientation or an educational program for new members to be able to sort of get a overview of what the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health is about, how they're organized, in particular the functions of each of the agency parts of the divisions of the agency, and then over time dig down a little more deeply about the various areas of responsibility in those agencies, how they carry them out, how they're funded, and the interplay between funding streams. So I thought that was a great idea. It was something that I thought all new members on both finance and the Health and Human Services Policy Committee would find helpful if they wanted to do it. And I've discovered that those of us who've been here a little while also are appreciative of the opportunity to review the overall Department of Human Services and Health. And so I just, for those of you who are here in the audience, I know that I've gotten some emails that seem to indicate to me there's some confusion about what this meeting is. It's not a meeting. It's not a hearing. It's not about debating or arguing about public policy. It's about learning about the Department of Human Services, how it's structured, how it functions, and what it does, in the interplay in the funding streams as a basis to help us understand the proposals that come before us during a legislative session. So I just want to make sure that everybody is clear about that. We wanted to inform everybody as to why we're meeting, but we aren't here in a hearing capacity. It's a class. It's an educational effort. Senator Claussen, would you like to add anything to that? You've been generous in helping sit down and sort of begin to lay out a curriculum for us. Our goal is that we get this done in a way that it can be put into a format that can be used over and over again, maybe even a course that has a credit associated with it. You know, the Corrections has a course that Hamlin puts on, Law for Legislators or something like that, that I need desperately also. But you know, I think the possibility is that if we can get this into a format that is truly an orientation, an overview, and we can get it done in a way that it can, our efforts today will not have to be duplicated over and over again, and it can simply be improved on. So would you like to say anything further?
Well, thank you, Senator Sharon. I think the educator in me came out after serving on Senator Lori's committee. I found that there are so many different programs, departments, that it would be helpful for me just to become better educated so I can become a better senator and better decision maker. So, I appreciate, you know, your offer to kind of run with this, and looking forward to this session and others. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And Senator Lori, chairs finance, as you all know, would you like to give us some words of wisdom? Or,
well, I was just going to ask Commissioner Jessen, did you apply for CLE credits then for this?
You know, I need them for my, you know, nurses need them, right, Chris? We could get some. I don't know if you can get them if you have to have them for licenses, but anything along that line is really appreciated. Okay, great. With that, I'm going to invite Commissioner Jessen up to the table. Again, I just, for context, want to have you understand what it is that I asked of the commissioner so that we don't ask her to do something different today than she's expecting. And that is to give us an understanding. And one of the things I got to tell you that was really great, when we sat down, Senator Claussen and I, with the commissioner, she brought with her a manual that she had used when she came in as an orientation manual and said, well, is it something like this? I went, I want that. Give that to me. Yeah, that is exactly right. We're trying to get a sense of the overall goal and direction. And how did you get oriented? And can you use some of what you learned in your orientation to help us with orientation? So welcome and thanks for giving us your time today. Then, one more thing. We're trying to figure out how to do this so that it's fun and interesting. I just want to remind you, we're not here to debate issues. We're here to learn about what is. And so when the commissioner and I were just talking a little bit ago, we thought we'll give an overview and then take a segment and then just see if there's some discussion or people want to talk about it. It's really not a debate, but remember our goal is to get oriented to what is and to use that as a basis for future proposals. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and it's great to be with you here this morning. As Senator Sharon said, when the three of us, when both of us sat down with Senator Claussen earlier, and I thought about that meeting and brought the nice little transition notebook the department had put together for me when I became walked in as commissioner and walked into a lot, because as many of you all remember, that was when we were, over $5 billion deficit. There was a lot going on. And this was a notebook I came back to so often. So often, I suppose you all feel like I felt like here's this huge budget, these budget issues and budget documents. And this is something the department had put together to kind of go in, as an overview for the department. So what we're trying to do, you know, if this works with your feedback, is to kind of provide that backdrop for new members, well, for all members as well. So what you'll have some takeaways. I know I'm putting them in a separate new notebook for myself, which you'll have some kind of the overview of the department. And then we'll start with Children's and Families this after I speak. And they'll have kind of a really an updated transition memo that they gave me when I became commissioner, which will at least give you everyone a starting place, we hope. So that's our goal as far as takeaways. I feel a little intimidated to be – I put these remarks together for new members, and there's so many of you who are here who have so much experience. So if I pause after kind of the different segments, that way not only can people ask me questions, but hopefully we'd have our experienced members also, you know, help enlighten those of us who are newer. So I started out with just talking about with this slide. Just the Department of Human Services, as so many of you know, it is so large and does so much. You know, I remember when, Kevin Goodnow talked to me as early when I was commissioning, and former Commissioner Goodnow said to me, he said, Cindy, just remember, you're running a department that touches over a million Minnesotans every year. You have over 7,000 employees. Mistakes are going to happen. You can't control every single thing that happens in the department. And I looked at him and I said, you know, Kevin, maybe there's 7,000 employees when you were commissioner. There aren't any more. We had a few budget cuts. But, I mean, I think back to that because it really just, I mean, it was one of those opening comments to the breadth of what we do, which is so important. So we provide essential services to Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. And we primarily serve children and seniors, people with disabilities. And I'm going to try and break down that. Who are those people we serve and kind of what do we think about when we go about that service? So I'm going to talk just to give you a brief outline a little bit about our mission and vision and who we serve. I'm going to talk then about kind of some of the integration efforts that we're undertaking with the legislature's direction and our work with the counties. Talk about some of the systems issues, kind of which I think are going to be important as you think about, as we're building, you're building a platform for future decision-making. I think looking at kind of some of our systems issues is going to be important as well. So that's kind of some of the major things. I'll talk a little bit at a high level about the budget, but I think we'll leave the details about the budget to kind of the different administrations. But certainly if there's more information you want about any of these things, you know, I can come back and provide that to you. Okay, so our mission, the Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. And those are words it's easy to gloss over, but I think they really help drive what we do. People think of the department, so I'm just at least sharing kind of some of my philosophy based upon this mission, which certainly predated, you know, my time as commissioner. It's a long-standing mission of the department. People think of us as providing safety net services. And in connection with many others, we do. But I think we provide not only safety net services, we try to do that a way where people can maintain their dignity when receiving them. And that we're not just providing a safety net, but really ladders up to where people, we try and help people not just have a safety net, but move out of poverty whenever possible and try and build incentives and programs that do that. And so to me, safety net, but yet ladders up. We tried last year to think about how do we have like a tagline, not that we wanted to change the mission, but something people could easily remember And so working at the department, we came up with healthy people, stable families, and strong communities. And they're really like building blocks to those strong communities, which we think mean so much to the state of Minnesota. So when we talk about over a million people, I should have perhaps asked former Commissioner Goodenow, how did you get to that million number? But it's probably significantly more than that. So I asked someone to put together a slide that talks about some of the big numbers of people that we serve. So you'll see just Medicaid, and so we shouldn't have two averages in that first slide. But so our average monthly people who are eligible for Medicaid, over 800,000. You add in Minnesota Care, 117,000. Okay, that's our health care programs. You're over 900,000. And these are, you know, and you, I don't think can assume that everyone is on all of these programs because we know that's not true. If you look at our MFIP, our Welfare to Work program, average monthly recipients is 109,000. And I would just want to remind everyone, because I think sometimes it's easily forgotten that 70% of those who receive those benefits, those are children. This is really a program that serves children. Our child care, and this is average monthly families, so it serves more children than that because these are families. At least I have four children. We all know many of us have more than one. So that's 17,000 there. Then it's something just kind of totally different, but in our licensing division, we conduct over 270,000 background studies every year. SNAP recipients, this is a number that's grown significantly over the past few years, but the average monthly was over 500,000.
Commissioner Jessen, the background studies, are you talking about for employees for you or background studies for people you're hiring to do work out in the community? Who's getting the background study?
Employers all over the state. So it's not just for people who work in our facilities, but our license. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for asking that question. But our licensing division, the legislature has directed them to do background studies for anyone who wants to come in and work with vulnerable adults, for example, or in a child care setting. You know, they need to have a background study before they're able to get those jobs. So we do them for hospitals and nursing homes and group homes, child care settings all over our state. And so this isn't like all the programs, but I just was trying to highlight some. And actually, when I looked at this slide, I realized that some of the most important numbers aren't up here, perhaps because they're smaller, but I thought this is a good time to talk about them. So this doesn't talk about the 11,000 children that we have in our foster care system. It doesn't talk about the 355 children we have who are in foster care today whose their parents' parental rights have been terminated and they're waiting for adoption. And we don't have families for them yet. This doesn't list the 11,000 clients and patients we see every year in our state-operated services. 5,000 of those just come through our dental clinics that mostly serve people with disabilities. So in some ways, and that's why I so welcome this opportunity, some of the smaller numbers, you can come in and there's a budget crisis, and I just say this from my perspective because I know this. You know, you can say, okay, wait, you know, DHS is a large part of the budget. Healthcare, Medicaid is a large driver of that. Let's focus on that, you know, and not think about some of these other programs that are so significant in people's lives and where we have some of our biggest challenges. So I thought we could talk about how we are organized at the department to serve these people. And, you know, it's interesting. So I asked yesterday.
Maybe before we get off those numbers, let me just also add, you know, I mean, you were talking about former Commissioner Goodenow saying you touched a million lives and you tally them up this way. There's also the families, too. And then families of people with disabilities, you're touching, I mean, I'm going to have to say way over 2 million. Just when I go through the math and think about how each of these really roll out, and it is an awesome undertaking.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Lori, I couldn't agree more. And I think especially when you think about the fact that, and I remind myself of this sometimes, there are 5.3 million Minnesotans. Mm-hmm. So in a very conservative basis, our programs touch one in five Minnesotans, and I think it's much more than that when you look at the families. And that's just a great opportunity, very sobering when you think about the breadth of the programs and what, you know, we're doing as a state. But yeah, also just the things that you all do and the decisions you make here just so directly impact so many Minnesotans.
If we can go through our agenda having these kinds of conversations, I think that that is helpful to us. So if anybody wants to sort of ask you a question at any time, that's okay with you. Is that correct, Commissioner? No?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Because it's really about really trying to understand what's coming at you here, not being polite for a presentation. If we're going to add to how many are impacted, you think about all the people who are being paid by the money that is being spent in the disability community or the long-term care community. You know, it's not just those we're serving, but then those who serve those we are serving are impacted also by what it is that we're doing, because they develop a whole healthcare system that's paid for by the rates that we establish. So the tentacles of this are just amazing. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We are in the process of coming up with a new organization chart, so I apologize for that. So the simple one that I think is we're trying to update, but it doesn't provide the detail that I wanted to walk through. So you really, I think, are presented with two. And I'll remind the committees that last session you gave us me the ability to have two deputy commissioners, and what we're really doing is organizationally is moving to where we have all of our direct care under Deputy Commissioner Barry, separated from all of our, the other work. So our direct care includes our state-operated services, as well as our Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program, and that's all. And that is the majority of our employees. So more than half of our employees do direct care, and the other half of our employees, which do the things that you. Most often kind of come to your attention, which is, you know, our policy areas in chemical and mental health, children and family services, continuing care, our healthcare administration. So you'll see on kind of the small slide, you know, and I apologize because this is, we're trying to, as I said, come up with a new organizational chart. But in some ways, just to think about the breadth of the department, kind of understanding that we are kind of doing this new alignment to kind of separate out direct care so that it has more direct oversight and accountability, which I think, frankly, it needs. And also sometimes our direct care comes in conflict with our licensing, because we license, our licensing division licenses some of our direct care. So that's another reason we've decided organizationally to have licensing and all the non-direct care report up through Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. Separately, we have all of our direct care report up through Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry, so that we're really trying to address perceived and actual conflicts of interest. But I think for purposes of just trying to get a sense of the breadth of the department, this more filled-in one, even if it's a little old, is helpful. And I just thought if I kind of walk you through how we are organized overall, and at the next time you meet, we'll have the complete updated organizational chart. And if I may, Madam Chair,
yes.
Tell a story about my work during the transition, when I worked for the transition team for Governor Dayton. And I was helping him, you know, get ready and interview commissioner candidates. And we would put together these nice notebooks for then governor-elect. And, you know, when he was interviewing commissioner candidates, he always wanted to start with the organizational chart. And, you know, then move to kind of what the resumes and some of the challenges and everything. And I remember when he got to interviewing the commissioners for the department, candidates for the Department of Human Services. And, you know, he had this organizational chart, and it wasn't one page. And then he opened it up, and it was two pages. And then he opened it up, it was three and four pages. And that is, we've tried to reduce the complexity on the organizational chart, but I think that reflects the complexity of what we're trying to do. And so what we have, if you look at this larger one, you'll see, I'm going to start in the corner, upper left-hand corner, and just kind of walk through some of these things. And it's probably easiest if you go, I'm looking at this larger, more filled-out one. Chemical and mental health services. So Dave Hartford is assistant commissioner there. And there we have our division that addresses our substance abuse, chemical health, a lot of our, you know, alcohol, drug abuse. We are the substance abuse, center for the state of Minnesota. You know, and that's interesting thinking back to some of Senator Clausen's comments about where does the Department of Health and where does the Department of Human Services kind of, where do they have, you know, where are they both doing some of the same things? We're the substance abuse authority for the state, as the legislature is directed, but certainly as the public health official, you know, Commissioner Ellinger certainly has a role to play there as well. He also, in the chemical and mental health, we also have in a separate adult mental health division and a children's mental health division. And I think separating children's mental health has been very helpful so that children's needs, which are often very different than, you know, adult mental health needs, don't get lost in the shuffle. I think that was something that was done, you know, years before I was commissioner, but that's been very helpful. So those are like the three divisions, and I think having them in one administration has been helpful because I think what we're trying to do is actually have more integration there. Most people with serious chemical dependency problems have mental health problems. There are a lot of, you know, co-occurring, looking at Senator Eden, she knows as well, it's often co-occurring. And so we're trying to have them not operate in their little silos, but really work together more. So if you go below that, you'll see our Children and Family Services Administration, Aaron Sullivan Sutton's Assistant Commissioner, and you'll hear from them today. And there are such a myriad of programs in that area that really try and provide, they talk about our deal with our child welfare system. A lot of our vulnerable adults work, our child support enforcement, child care services. It's, you know, you'll hear more about that this afternoon, but it's a lot of our economic supports, our general assistance program, our NFIP program, all come out of Children and Family Services. You know, in many states you would see this be its own agency. And it's a significant part of what we do. Below that, we're going further down, we have our Continuing Care Administration. It's headed by Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman. And I would say I'm very fortunate to have assistant commissioners who've been with the department for an extended period of time and have a real history. You know, I think Assistant Commissioner Coleman's 10th year with the department. And it's, so they do a lot of our work with aging and adult services, disability services, deaf and hard of hearing. So one of the things often people don't know is we actually have areas around the state where we provide services for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And you'll hear that, you can hear about that separately as well. Obviously, this is a part of the department where I think we have around 300 employees there, but it's a significant amount of dollars, especially as we look at the upcoming demographics for our state. We know that this is going to be a focus of more and more attention and more need. Our healthcare administration, if you look at the bottom corner, Assistant Commissioner Scott Leitz, who I know many of you know, this includes our state Medicaid program. So our state Medicaid director reports up to our Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare. And this runs our Minnesota Care program and has overall responsibility for our Medicaid program. But when you say that, it's Medicaid, our Medicaid program really has tentacles throughout the department because we're really obviously Medicaid dollars are used a lot in our continuing care administration. We're really trying to use more Medicaid funding in our children's and families area to, you know, hopefully provide more housing. So Medicaid and certainly we're trying to meld our Medicaid program with our chemical and mental health services. So just to give you like one example, you know, we have a lot of funding silos, and we'll kind of come to this. So we'll have like separate funding for our chemical health, separate funding sometimes through, you know, often grants for mental health, separate funding for our aging services, and a whole separate funding for kind of our more traditional, you know, hospital clinic services. And that's one of the things we do need to integrate. And so to have these programs, different parts of our agency working together, and Medicaid's something that can be that binding force. But I'll come back to that maybe in a bit. So if you kind of move.
Commissioner, yes. May I ask here, first of all, welcome, senators. We've just oriented everybody that this is a class. We're trying to get oriented to what is in place, how it's organized and functions. It's a new member orientation. We're all new members today. But it's not a hearing. Some language has come out that suggests it's been a hearing, or and it's not about a debate. It's about us getting oriented. So we're hoping you ask questions to help you understand what is, not what you want to be, what you want something to be, but what is, so that we can use it as a basis for future proposals and regulatory changes. So thank you. But on this particular issue, this Medicaid Administration, State Medicaid Director. This really isn't a direct service as much as it is managing all the resources that are integrated in a variety of ways to support these direct services. Would that be an accurate statement?
Madam Chair, our Medicaid program, funds medical assistance, which obviously funds a number of these things, like does some of the funding for our mental health services, continuing care services. When you talk about direct care, in the Department of Human Services, our direct care staff that, and we'll get to that in a second, that, we run Security Hospital, as you know, and a lot of our care programs, which provide treatment for people with chronic chemical dependency programs and ANOCA and a lot of, So that's when I think of direct care. A lot of that is funded by Medicaid, but not all of it. Some of it is only funded with state dollars. So it's not all of our direct care is funded by Medicaid. Some of it is and some of it isn't.
But this particular square on the organizational chart is referring.
She's working off a different chart right now.
Oh, aren't you? Am I looking at the wrong?
She's working off of this chart right now.
Jesus.
Sorry.
Never mind.
I apologize. Oh,
nevertheless, I think I can still ask the question. When you're talking about Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Scott Lights, he's trying to figure out all of the funding issues here that support and then get these dollars get directed out to all these other divisions that are actually carrying out responsibilities or functions. I have that essentially correct. Is that in terms of Scott's area of responsibility?
Madam Chair, I would say that Scott's area of responsibility, is because it's responsible for Medicaid, for medical assistance, overall has probably 80% of the DHS dollars flowing through it.
Okay.
There are some additional dollars that fund, let's say, mental health grants that are separate from that, some other things. But, yes, 80%, the vast majority of the dollars flow through that, and a lot of it goes to support the work of other administrations.
And then welcome, Senator Hayden. May I give an example to help me clarify in my mind what you're talking about? One of the areas that we've been working on, trying to figure out how to make policy recommendations in the next legislative session, is around non-emergency medical transportation, which Assistant Commissioner Lights has been involved in. So because it is a use of Medicaid dollars, anybody that's on medical assistance is eligible for non-emergency medical transportation. So would he then not only be paying attention to those dollars, but also to the policies for how those dollars are being spent?
Madam Chair, yes. And so I know, for an example, he's working closely with Assistant Commissioner David Hartford, because that's particularly an issue often for our mental health and chemical dependency area. There are a lot of clients with those needs who also need non-emergency medical transportation. So he would be thinking about not just the dollars, but the policy, and not just health care policy, but health care writ large, including kind of mental health and chemical dependency, for an example.
But we're likely to see him come and talk about that rather than Dave Hartford?
Madam Chair, you would be, but I think one of the things, and we'll get to this a bit, that we're trying to do with the department is actually make them, having these cross-agency collaborations on these important issues. And so, and that is certainly one. And why we're trying to actually move towards having, I'll get to that in a bit, kind of a set of major agency initiatives. So it's not just all, here's what the healthcare administration is doing, here's what the mental health, divisions are doing. But they need to be worked together, because what we need to do, I would say, overall, is move to actually an integrated health and human services system, where we're not just talking, because right now we have too many funding silos, which mirror our administrative silos, and that's hard for county workers to navigate. And I'm delighted that Paul Fleschner from Olmsted County is going to be up here to talk to you about that later. It's hard for our county workers. It's hard for people, and it's not very efficient. So that's why I think what you just said is a good example of why we need to look at this as much more of an integrated system.
Thank you.
Shall I move on the organizational chart? Are there other? Okay. So I'm not going to go through every single box here. I want to note towards the bottom of the bigger sheet that we do have a kind of new community relations director, because we're really trying to do more to work with the community and clients that we serve and to do more direct outreach to get their input. County relations, we've elevated that to kind of report to the commissioner's office, because I've made a big push around having better working relationships with our county partners and also with the tribes. So those are kind of two positions we've really tried to elevate within the department. State-operated services, as I said, this box gives you starts to give you a sense of the breadth of the work that we do here. This now is reporting directly to Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry. But at least looking at this box, you'll kind of start to get a sense of the work that we do. As I said, we see 11,000 clients every year. About 5,000 of those are through our dental clinics. But there are others through our MSOCs, which are like more of our group homes, which serve people with disabilities. And those are more often four-bedroom group homes. We also have kind of MIF homes, kind of more family foster care. But a lot of these are, you know, we have, I think it is seven. Subacute psychiatric hospitals, our CBHHs, which are, you know, 16-bed psychiatric hospitals around the state. We also have, you know, serve folks at Anoka Regional Treatment Center, at Security Hospital within our, and we've now kind of divided that up into kind of three different areas in state-operated services. And I know that Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry is going to be here and talk about this in more detail, but we've tried to divide it between kind of our community work, including our MSOCs homes, and our mental health system, including our CD system, which is both our, you know, Anoka and our CBHHs, which are these psychiatric hospitals, and our care facilities. And our care facilities include facilities that really provide residential care for people with chronic substance abuse programs. For example, I just Senator Lori went up and toured Liberalis in Carleton. You know, where they serve probably, you know, 25 to 30 women in that program. You know, often they're there to deal with their serious substance abuse issues for 60 to 90 days. You know, pretty good outcomes, but very intensive. You know, much more than they get kind of probably in a different setting. Not exactly your 28-day model, but these are people with, you know, often we serve the people with the most chronic problems that others in that system wouldn't take. Those are just some examples. So we have our mental health system, and then we have what we think of as our forensic services, which is Security Hospital, and our competency restoration program, and those are our major parts of that program. That's a whole topic that's very broad. As I think I said earlier, it's a part of the department that I thought needed more oversight and accountability. That's why we've come up with kind of a new management team and structure, more direct reporting, and, you know, we can talk about that now or later. But as I said, that more than half of the employees of the department work for this part of the department, even though when you look to the budget size slide, you'll see it's a very small part of our budget. And then on the far right, you'll just see some of our kind of infrastructure that we have, including, you know, budget analysis, financial operations. You know, we have tried to really heighten the work of our Office of Compliance, and I really appreciate the legislature giving us, you know, more internal auditors and kind of really helping us beef up our internal auditing and compliance last session. And we are also trying to strengthen our Office of Inspector General. And, you know, once again, I appreciate the efforts the legislature gave to help us, you know, beef up what I see as the important parts of the office in compliance and making sure that we're having more auditors and to make sure we're doing a good job and the counties are doing a good job overseeing these programs and money, and the Office of Inspector General making sure that we do more to prevent and detect fraud when it happens. And our Office of Inspector General also includes our licensing division, and that gets back to the number of background studies and, you know, licensing. And licensing, getting back to, I think, a question you raised earlier, Senator Clausen, is something that the Department of Human Services licenses some things, and the Department of Health licenses others. And we can kind of get into that as much as you all like, but for an example, the Department of Health licenses hospitals and nursing homes. We license chemical dependency treatment centers, you know, more of quite traditional group homes. We license daycare. So there's a division of the different things the two departments do. And I know that especially for new members, and can I say new commissioners sometimes, that gets confusing. but that's why I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. So I was going to go on, but I'm happy to just answer any questions or take comments or ask any of more senior members here to weigh in on the organizational challenges or for new members.
We're going to pause every now and then, make sure that everybody is sort of understanding what's being said, and making sure questions you've had for years get clarified. Maybe, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the folks that just came in, there is a test afterwards. thank you, Commissioner, for this overview. My question is in the policy and operations. And there seems to be an expansion. There's about four new positions: community relations, county relations, Office of Indian Affairs, and, as Senator Sherman said, state-operated services. And then at the top you have communications, public affairs. It seems to be a little redundant. Can you explain what those new positions are going to be?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. And when I say new positions, these are things that kind of were part of a reorganization at the beginning when I started as commissioner. County relations actually is a position that's been a long time in the department. Before it was reporting up through, actually, I think the Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services, I wanted to work to improve our relationships with the counties. And so I wanted to raise the profile of that and have it report directly to either the deputy commissioner or me. So it wasn't a new position, but we tried to, like, bring that work into the commissioner's office. And the same is true for the Office of the Indian Policy. You know, same thing. This is kind of an office that existed before, but at a lower level. And I was trying to raise to heighten the visibility and importance of that work. The community relations person, we reallocated within the department because we wanted to be more to seek more input from clients wherever possible. That's one person. So it's a little different than communications, just because we're trying to focus on communications with the community that we serve. I saw that as a challenge sometimes. Sometimes you kind of think of the stakeholders who are more the people who are the regular suspects who show up at hearings, and we were really trying to reach out and get input from people we serve in our programs, you know, and the communities that they come from. And so this was more of a liaison position to work with particularly communities of color, where we didn't feel we were always getting the feedback that we needed and the connections that we needed with them to inform how we move forward in our programs.
Thank you. Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioner Jessen, do we have advisory councils in place for the various departments? These would be actual practitioners that are out there that perhaps have contracts with various departments that meet on a regular basis just to kind of talk about process and how things might work better, streamlining. Do we ever have those kinds of discussions?
Go ahead. This is not a hearing. I'm hoping we can have a conversation.
Okay. Senator Claussen, yes, we do, and that would be an excellent – I mean, I'll give you kind of a broad overview, but that would be an excellent question to ask each of the – you know, administrations when they come up, to talk about how they do that. There's some things we do kind of at a global level. For an example, we're talking about the Office of Indian Policy. We have an Indian Affairs, I forget the exact name of it, but advisory committee, you know, from the tribes and other, just to give us advice about dealing with Native American issues across our state and across our programs. So that's something that's more at across the department level. We also have a disparities reduction kind of cultural competency group that does the same thing across the department. We have quarterly meetings with the counties and a county state kind of trying to remember the exact name of it, partnership that we meet, where we meet quarterly with the heads of not just county human services directors but leads of county commissioners on county state issues. So we do some of those things at a whole department level, but then we also have different administrations have different kind of advisory groups as well. So there's not, like you say, it's the Department of Human Services and here's the advisory group for the department. It is, we have a number of them just because of the breadth of the issues.
Are those advisory groups, some are put in place by the legislature, and then some are just initiated within the department in order to achieve an objective, is there a way or a process that if people have ideas for how efficiencies or improvements could be made, oftentimes we hear ideas on the street that come to us. Where do we channel them in order to be able to get input to the department,
Senator? some of you will get to know the different assistant commissioners, and if it's about a specific area, you may learn, oh, it's an idea about children and families. I should talk with Aaron Sullivan Sutton. But when in doubt, let me just say, our amazing legislative director, Amy Delwo, is the best person to channel things through. And Amy and I talk about every day, and then we will get those ideas to the right people. And she will get back to you about what we do.
And those advisory committees are, some of them are established by the legislature, like the Mental Health Advisory Task Force is a legislative. And various legislators serve on various of these task forces if the law defines that there should be a legislator on them, right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, most of them, I would say, are, you know, created by the legislature. I do have authority as commissioner to create, you know, up to a certain number, I forget, it's four or five, you know, additional advisory committees, you know, which I've exercised on a couple of different occasions.
And some of those have travel expenses paid and some don't, and there's various reasons historically as to how that happened, I suppose. And the Sunset Commission, really, remember, we had a sunset process to review all the various advisory boards and commissions for their continuing necessity. Right.
Just to orient.
Oh, but Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for these two charts. I think they'll be extremely helpful in constituent service and other areas and in just a broader understanding.
Senator Nelson, were you here when the commissioner indicated that these are being updated? They aren't exactly accurate yet, so don't give them out too far. That they'll be updated within the next month or so, right?
No, thank you for that clarification. I will wait for the updated ones. I had a question about the last box, which is the state-operated services. And it's not – well, it's a somewhat of an organizational question. But I'm thinking about two things. Will we have someone from state-operated services be visiting later today?
Not today.
Okay. Well, then I'll just ask my questions. Two things. One, I'm wondering about if there's any update on the suggestions from the OLA report of this past February as far as some of the needs for some policy changes in state-operated services. So I'm wondering if we might have an update on that. Part of that, too, is with the – and you might have already touched on this before I got here, but the incident in St. Peter with the gentleman who was released on the street corner. I'm just curious, are there policy changes? I think it was a mentally ill gentleman who was released because of a oversight, I think, and then with no follow-up. And are there things in place? Have you started to change things to make sure that that type of thing doesn't happen again?
I'd like to just interrupt here to reorient, Senator, that we're really learning about what is in place now as a basis for understanding the department what's happening. We have a hearing coming up very specifically on state-operated services, their update on the recommendations of her change from the auditor's report, and on these other issues that are coming up. And they're preparing to meet with us. What's the date on that, Chelsea? Do you remember?
September
26th, I'm assuming notices are coming out. But it's a specific hearing of our committee, and Finance will be joining us on that issue. But if there's some brief update you want to give, that'll be great. But I just want to reorient our committee here that this is an educational time to learn about what is, and we will have a hearing very specifically on the things that you're concerned about.
Thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to say there is a hearing coming up about that. We're going to give you an exact update on where we are on the OLA report. But let me just say briefly on the event, what happened was there was a client at Security Hospital who was committed as mentally ill, not mentally ill and dangerous. And I think we have – but was transferred because of some behaviors from Anoka to Security Hospital. Security Hospital used to dealing with people who are mentally ill and dangerous who go through the, you know, whole different process, missed the 60-90-day review. They found it, realized they missed it, which you have to, if you don't turn in those reviews, then the commitment is over. Our clinicians thought he was ready for discharge, but they obviously, one, shouldn't have missed the review. and shouldn't have and should have done a better job of discharge planning. No one should be discharged mm-hmm. to a homeless shelter. I mean, and that's kind of an issue. It's for the county, for us. That shouldn't have happened. So what I have done, when I looked at it just very briefly into this, when I found out that this happened, it seemed to me that what happened wasn't, it wasn't like one person made a mistake. This is a system that didn't work. And so what I, and our licensing division is looking at that from a licensing perspective, but I thought, and I thought it was a system that wasn't, though, just Security Hospital. This is what happens in those instances where we take someone from Anoka and send them where they are, should go to Security Hospital. Security Hospital accepts them, but they don't have all of these systems in place for treating people who are something besides mentally ill and dangerous. This is a serious systems issue. And so that's why I contracted, actually, with an outside some outside expert to come in and do what I think Senator Sharon and I talked about, which is a root cause analysis, to say, to look at, you know, what went wrong here from a systems perspective, what do we need to change, what do we need to do to address this, to take that broader look. So that is supposed to be due by the end of, to us, by the end of September. So, I, you know, we are looking at not just from a license perspective, but also from a really, what went wrong, how do we make sure we have systems in place so that something like this doesn't happen again?
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'll look forward to that hearing. And now I didn't catch the dates. It'd be really helpful if we had that hearing after the report came back so we can
make sure we have the right
make sure we have the right information, and then going forward for this short legislative session that's before us, make sure we know, are there any things from the OLA report that require legislation?
That's right. That's
and are
the
there
goal.
Any things in the report that you'll get in September that the legislature needs to weigh in on? So thank you.
Yes, that is absolutely our goal for the hearing, to understand what might much of this may be systems. It's systems analysis, good developing a process for good systems analysis, and building in redundancy so that the system doesn't fall apart when it does, to have a good postmortem on it, to have a good process to understand what happened. And is our date after, is our hearing date going to align well with what you're able to give us in terms of information?
Well, I asked for the report to be done. It's in the contract by the end of September. I can check in and see if it's possible if we can get it early, because I think the hearing date's that last week of September.
Yeah,
so I'll have to check with that.
Thank you.
Okay,
any other questions on the organizational chart of the mission? Yeah, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Jensen. I was kind of intrigued with the line that talked about the community relations and some of the work we've done with Ms. Wilcoxon and others and the groups that we set up there. And I know that we've talked a lot of it in this committee about health disparities. And so, you know, I think what I want to, you know, understand is, throughout the organizational chart, with the exception of the community relations, which I'm not absolutely 100% sure what Ms. Wilcoxon is going to do. Is it just going to be liaison work, or but where is the, we talk about health disparities a lot and health access, and we're kind of talking about it now with Minshew, and I'll leave that for the appropriate time. But where is what in your organizational chart is reflecting the work that your organization is doing to reduce health disparities?
Senator Hayden, I think that's not something, we didn't put our like major goals and all the work we're trying to do on that organizational chart. And from my perspective, we need to look at disparities, not just in healthcare, but also, can I just say, in our child welfare programs, for example, or disparities in all of our programs. You know, that shouldn't be some one person's job. That has to be all of our jobs. And I think when we get to what our kind of framework for the future, you'll see kind of we have on our dashboard some things that directly relate to equity, to decrease disparities and improve outcomes, you know, that we're trying to hold people accountable for. So I think that's where you'll see, you know, how we're trying to direct that work.
And just to follow up, would you talk again about this community liaison with the communities, how you sort of see that functioning?
Well, I mean, this is new.
Yeah.
So it is all a work in progress. But what I know is that since Antonia Wilkerson has started doing this, she's helped us get out and hold meetings in places where we get communications more from people on our programs, where I'm going and before we even things as simple as, and this isn't just Antonia, but we're just trying to be more conscientious of this throughout our programs. For example, when we were thinking about what proposals we wanted to make to our InFIT programs, one of the things that we worked on with Children's and Family Services was, even things as simple as I went to meetings with a lot of, parent moms mostly, but some dads, who are on InFIT. What's working for them? What's not working for them? So that we're hearing not just from, the counties and kind of the providers, but we're hearing from people themselves. And that's something that the department had not done as much of before, and I think is important. And so that when we were talking about, putting together our proposal-less session for autism, a new autism benefit, we went, Antonio was one of those who, with others, made sure we were out. This is a big issue in the Somali community. We went out and had a lot of meetings with them in the Somali community. I don't think that, not saying they agree with everything we did, but I mean just making those efforts to make the connections so that we get input is really, I think, critical to our success. And so that's what we're really striving to do. But on the other hand, you can't say, oh, this one person is responsible for reducing disparities. This person is working with a whole department to try and make sure that we're getting actually more input from people on our programs.
Okay.
So,
excuse me, Senator. I just want to follow up, and then we'll go to.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Justice. So, I agree with you. I think that the whole department and each of the leaders in each of your areas should be responsible for that. I think what I'm looking for, or what I want to better understand, is who's ultimately responsible, and who should we hold accountable if those numbers don't change?
That would be me.
So I think that's really important, Madam Chair, Commissioner, because I think that what I find is that the numbers aren't changing dramatically, or they're not changing much at all, and that it seems that as we talk about this each and every year, it's a conversation of, well, we're trying, we'll get back to you, that's a great suggestion, we're going to try to do better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that we just end up in this same place. And so what I'm looking for is that I'd like for us to maybe think about, Madam Chair, as we some goals, and Commissioner, about how do we do this, and then ultimately if they don't change, then we hold you accountable, because you just said you'd be the person. We'd hold you accountable for the lack of change. I just feel this sense of urgency that we have to really do something. In the 5 years that I've been around here, they haven't changed, and then ultimately when we bring it up, there's some kind of new philosophy or process that we go through that ultimately is not getting us to where we want to go, or at least in my estimation, where we want to go. So I think that's going to be important.
Senator Hayden, let me reframe what your concern is into a question to help orient us to what is. Then if we need to make recommendations, we can do that through the legislative process. Because I'd like to use our time here to help us understand what is. So I think the question, and you may have already answered it, is what is in place that strengthens our ability to see that marker change on disparities in a variety of places? There's a benchmark that we're trying to see an actual change in the how we evaluate disparities. What is how is the administrative structure being formed to assure that that doesn't fall through the cracks and does, in fact, get the attention it needs? Even though you're saying that we want it to be distributive, not singular, we want it to be an objective that's measured in each division, what in the system that you're organizing now, as it exists now, addresses that issue?
Well, actually, if I may, move from organizational chart kind of to the next section, we'll talk about some of that, if I may.
Okay.
And you may say, well, I would choose different measures if I were you, Commissioner. But I think we are trying to choose outcome measures and be very clear about how we're doing. We're doing well on some and we're not doing well on some. So we are trying to move towards more accountability. So
I think we would be interested to know how you're organizing your administrative structure to attack that issue. So, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I'm looking at the massive number of people and telephone numbers and the variety of services that you offer. Can you give me a little feel about how a person would fit into an ombudsperson role and where that relates, how that gets to you, for instance? Because there's a lot of times people are they hit a ceiling somewhere trying to get answers. Where does an ombudsperson fit in here?
Oh, great question, Senator. Well, and the legislature has really directed some of that, and it's not all in this chart. So, for an example, our ombudsperson for mental health and disabilities, Roberta Opheim, she has her own office. And so when things come to her attention, and we have to make, like, if something goes wrong that we see in our direct care, you know, we send notices to Roberta, so do, you know, counties and others. And if she sees something going wrong, kind of that she thinks that gets my attention, frankly, Roberta just calls me. I mean, sometimes she'll go to the lower-level person, but if it's something troubling, she'll, like, send me an email, she'll talk to me, she'll talk to one of the deputy commissioners. So that's kind of in the role that she has. We also have, like, an ombudsperson for long-term care. That ombudsperson and her staff, Deb Holtz, is really good. That she actually reports in our reporting structure. She's a DHS employee, so that's a different model for an ombudsperson. So you have, like, Roberta is an ombudsperson who has an independent office. Deb's office is within the department, but operates, believe me, very independently. And, you know, she technically, I think, reports to Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman. But, you know, I have a lot of interactions with Deb. And so she deals with kind of the long-term care issues. We have an ombudsperson for managed care. So when people feel like they're not getting answers, you know, if they're on one of our health care programs, they're not getting responses from our through the plans, they'll often call the ombudsperson for managed care. You know, and we use that really as a way to hear about, look, what's not working. Because if we'll see, okay, we get a lot more managed care ombudsman's complaints around this time about these topics, you know, we'll sit down and talk with the plans and go, what's wrong here? What do we need to change? Because we're getting a lot more complaints about, let's say, lack of access to something recent, you know, services for autism providers. You know, okay, we're getting more complaints about that from our autism ombudsperson. That tells us that's something we need to fix. But I would say that's an example of where just the legislature has made decisions to put different to have different ombuds people for different areas have very different reporting relationships and different, some are more independent than others.
Thank you.
That's an interesting, that I did not understand that before. So I appreciate your question, Senator. And it is your impression, may I ask you, the independent ombudsperson can be a strong advocate for the consumer and not experience concerns about employment or losing favor. But those that are actually in the system, is that an issue? Is there an issue here? Because this person is really designed to be an advocate for the consumer, correct?
I mean, I think, Senator, different ombuds people have different directives, you know. But, yes, I mean, overall, I would say that absolutely to be the case. It's not that people within this, you know, who work for DHS don't have, you know, civil service or sometimes, you know, other protections, you know, and some depends upon the personality. But I think those are choices that the legislature makes kind of, you know, when setting up different structures. So I'm back in my reflecting on what is, so that you'll kind of have a basis for thinking about things moving forward. I must say, one of the things when I came in, I thought about, should I just have all the people who are ombuds, have those ombuds roles, be in one office? Here, the ombuds office. Would that be better for the department? You know, where they would have then kind of more of an independent role of directly reporting to a deputy commissioner, to me. You know, and that's something I went back and forth about, and that's kind of, and if I felt that I wasn't hearing directly from them, I was going to do that. But what I found once I got in the job is I hear from these people, you know. But I do think, I mean, so there's some organizational choices I think we make too.
Yes. I just wanted to comment that having been on the other side working in the mental health and SOS, that they're very responsive. I mean, if a client doesn't feel like they're getting the services they should, they know how to get a hold of the ombudsman and you hear from them. And it's a good thing because then all the players know what's going on and what the concern is. And or if you have a bad outcome and then somebody overdoses or has some kind of a crisis, we do a thorough review, and it's helpful and kind of a analysis of what caused it, you know, and also in the sense of how we can prevent it in the future. So it's, I feel they have a really good role. I really appreciated all the interactions.
So I'm just going to quickly make the point that this running human services is not something DHS or even the state of Minnesota really, our government overall, just does alone, that we work with a lot of folks. I mean, I think this is obvious. You know, our federal government is a huge partner, and finance is about half of our human services system. County human services agencies are just a tremendously important partner. They administer most of these services. They provide most of the direct client contact. And so we – and, you know, that may be something – you know, as you move forward, you may hear about some county redesign efforts that are going on where they're working together. Probably too much to go into here on human services. Certainly Paul Fleschner will be able to fill you in on some of the things that are going on in southeast Minnesota. And as I think I mentioned earlier, I've been trying to make, you know, having a closer working relationship with both the counties and the tribes be part of what I was trying to do. We also work a lot with, you know, nonprofit organizations, anyone from, you know, Blue Cross Minnesota to Faith in Action. I mean, with nonprofits across our state, as well as a number of for-profit providers. A number of the pharmacies, our long-term care providers are for-profits. It is truly, I mean, think the breadth of human services, even if you say, well, it's the state and the counties, it doesn't begin to describe our system. But it is a system, when you kind of look at all that, it is set up for fragmentation. And, you know, it's very complex. If you look at kind of the different number of systems, let me just give you a couple of examples. I think the hardest, we were looking at housing because we were thinking about what should we be doing more for housing, because something, not having housing is one of those things that really drives a lot of problems, like addiction does, across all of our administration and all of our areas. So we thought, well, what do we do for housing within the department? And Erin Sullivan-Sutton could talk about this more. So she did a survey. We have 23 different housing programs at DHS. 23 in different parts of our department. And I think they were all a good idea. They're all serving some niche or maybe to help one particular provider, but 23 housing different programs. I mean, that's one example of complexity, and that's just in housing. And, of course, we're not even a housing finance agency, right? And we know there are housing programs across state government. But when people come in and there's this myriad of programs that we've just kind of seen in an organizational chart, and you have a county financial worker that's trying to say, okay, here's someone that I'm looking at their form, you know, is it, you know, are they need NFIP because there are a whole set of eligibility rules around NFIP, or is it GA, or do they need, or they, can they qualify for child care? Where would they be on the waiting list? Do they kind of need some of our chemical dependency services, which come through, well, let's assess them for that, which is a whole different funding system. And that's before we even get to, is it Medicaid? Is it Minnesota Care? Do they need some, you know, special supports because they have disabilities or a child with a disability? You know, I've often said, I really believe it is true, the complexity of our system makes it, I think the hardest job in our human services work is to be a county financial worker. Just to try and navigate for a family, for a person sitting in front of them, what are they eligible for, how to get them into it, you know, which one of the 23 housing programs might help this individual. You know, you don't want to have them kind of miss one because of something small, you know, and so we really end up with a fragmented system that's driven, you know, I think by great intentions, adding things here or there to try and make things work better, but it is very unnecessarily complex. We have a lot of silos, and we need to work across them to really actually get to the better outcomes that you were talking about, Senator. So if I would just say, I think some of the things I've been focused on, I think if we try and do this transformation, is we need a system that's more integrated, so that we're not just talking about all these separate programs, but kind of like is more client focused on what do we need to do for this person. And it's centered on the needs of people, and it's focused on outcomes and not just process, because most of these programs are focused on process outcomes. And to me, I just would say I'm glad you're doing this, because I think it's something that's now is the time to really move forward on this. I think sometimes people think about change we need in human services when they're really super difficult economic times, because that's when more people need human services, right? It's that counter-cyclical thing. More people need to be on the programs when times are bad, and when times are bad, states' budgets are hurt. But I think this is, as things are getting a little better, is a time to really kind of continue to push the change, because, these challenges aren't going to go away, particularly given the demographics of our state, and we really need to continue to push for this more integrated outcome-oriented system. And so that's one of the things we've started to do, and we did in 2012, and now we're doing in 2013. And this is just pretty high level, but trying to get at what are our major department-wide goals, things that we're highlighting to do. And it's not everything that we're doing, obviously, at the department, but I wanted to try and put on one page, and I think you've got a copy of it in here, kind of make sure we remember our mission and our values, and then highlight the major goals we're trying to achieve, and particularly to focus on those that cross administrations, where it's not just, oh, this is what children and families are doing, here's their list. But so that when we like looking at the, third bullet, like the serve more people in their homes and communities rather than institutions, that crosses a lot of our department. Some of these are kind of just, administration specific, but a lot of these extend smarter purchasing strategies to reward value rather than volume. Once again, that's everything from childcare to medical assistance to, to our home and community-based service purchasing, something we're really trying to do across the board. And so what we tried to do is, like, come together, and this is where we're trying to bring together through our senior management team the department saying, let's, instead of just having every administration say, here's what I'm working on this year and the goals, what are the main things we need to work together on together? Where are we going to prioritize and say, these are the most important things? So that's where we're going to spend our resources, to the extent, even if we have to reprioritize within the agency. And so coming up with this on a yearly basis is part of helping drive what we want, our priorities and our goal setting. And then what we tried to do was, and like everything else is a work in progress, is to make this outcome, to say we want to be more outcome-focused instead of process-focused and not have just process measures. So some of these are, but most of them we're trying to drive towards outcome measures, is to be able to measure them, obviously. And so we tried to then tie them to a dashboard. And we started the dashboard just with a few basic things in 2011, but we've really tried to this year say, okay, for each of these things, you should be able to click into our dashboard and see how we're doing. Some of the measurements are going to be better than others, but you'll be able to go on and Amy said she'd come and help, see if we can figure out how to do this for you, but so that you could actually link and say, okay, they have a goal of, serve more people in their homes and communities rather than institutions. So we've got, go to the dashboard on our website, and then you'll see, home and communities. Oh, that's housing access services, which is a good one, but let's go back to the this is a return to community initiative, and you'll talk about what our goals are, and are we meeting them or not, and that's return to community is where we're actually reaching out to people who are in nursing homes but voluntarily want to return to the community, and how we're able to help them. And then for each of these they'll say, are we on track? This is kind of needs work or caution, or needs work, which is red, or caution, not sure this is going as well as it should. And you'll see kind of ratings for each of these. So what we've tried to do is for each of our goals, each of our things we say we're going to do on here, to be able to say, okay, here's how we're going to measure our progress, and to make that measurement very public.
So in that graph, can you hold the graph that's there?
Okay, let's go back. Okay, that graph. Okay.
That's the graph that's showing us that the dashboard is the red line there. Is that the goal?
The goal.
And then your bar graphs are showing you where you're at in relationship to that at any given period of time?
Yes.
So you're exceeding your objective at the very end, and
and prior some of those earlier, and it's showing general progress, decreasing progress, and then reestablishing again.
And I'll be honest, in some things you'll see goals where you'll say, you know, this needs improvement. Mm-hmm. You know, the caution here. You know, we're not just we're choosing. We were pretty explicit on choosing stretch goals. You know, so if you go, let's what?
Which one did you want to?
Do you want to go to some of the equity ones since Senator Hayden was asking about that? So we have some equity goals here that we're just trying, and it's not all of our equity goals, because like I said, as you can imagine with, you know, 6,500 employees and all the work we do, we have a lot more individual goals in this. These are just the higher profile ones, but we're trying to, this is one we're talking about, the children of color and out-of-home placement. And this is one where we're saying, you know, and so we're trying to lower the number of children of color in foster care. Because this is one of those areas where we see real disparities. We have far too many, especially American Indian children in out-of-home placements and in foster care. And so this is one where we're saying, you know, look, this caution here. You know, we're not doing as well as we should here. So I guess I'm trying to say we are, you know, and I don't need to go through each one of these, but we are trying to be much more explicit as an agency saying, here are the major things we're working on, they're important to us, and to be public about how we're measuring our progress. And as a senior management team, we sit down and go over these for different parts of the department, you know, on a quarterly basis. So we'll have children and families come in and say, here's what we're doing. And we have internal indicators as well that we don't put on our public dashboard that are probably more, but we're trying to at least move towards making as much public as we can and having them be outcome measures, not just, you know, how many people did you process?
How many people did you serve? So are you able in this instance, just using this as an example, when you see that you've set and established a dashboard and you're not achieving it, then you do some thorough analysis of the contributing factors, and some of those things you can resolve within your department, and some you have to come back to the legislature with and ask for change. So are we able to use things like this in our presentations to the legislature? I think, especially when the department brings its budget forward, if you're operating off of, it would be helpful to me in policy to say, you know, this is the objective. This is the one that's within the children services or whatever it is. This is what we're finding. This is why we're asking for what we're asking for, because we want to establish the goal of changing the outcome on this dashboard.
I think that would be a really good idea, Senator. And I think that, like, for example, when Children and Family Services talks this afternoon, you can talk about how they've used this tracking process to try and change some of what they're doing. But I think in the equity one, you'll see that, like, our second one is to reduce that access, to reduce the gap in access and outcomes for health care in cultural and ethnic communities. So that is something we are once again trying to use this process to address. So I would just go back to, like, Senator Hayden's question about how are we trying to do that? We're trying to do that across the department and to do that in a way where we can track how we're doing. And so we say if it's not doing it, then we need to make changes so we can do a better job. So I don't mean to go through all of this, but I just at least wanted you all to be aware of, I think when I talked about being more integrated and being more outcome-focused, this is one of the things we're trying to do in that regard.
Anything, Senator Hayden? Did you want to ask anything here at this point?
Well, I appreciate you tracking it, and I appreciate you having a dashboard. I just am a lot more interested in it changing, and so I don't mean to be flip at all. I'm just saying that I think that those are great tools that we have, and I think that the idea that somehow if it's not working, maybe come to us and get more resources. But I'm just a lot more interested in, you know, more of a higher level of accountability to why these things aren't changing, and then maybe a much more thorough analysis of why they're not changing, and then how can we get them to change. And I think these tools are helpful to kind of give us a sense of where we're at and a snapshot, but I don't think it addresses the issue that I'm trying to get at, which is much more around how do we start to make those changes. And so I won't bog your time here today
I would say that it's absolutely a baseline piece of information you need in order to get where you want to go. You have to have a measure of what initiatives that you are now expending your resources on, and are they doing the job? And that's going to tell us they aren't, or they are. And if they are, then you know you got the right investment going, so you keep it going. But if it isn't, then you have to do another analysis and make another proposal for change, because the expectation is that you meet the objective. And I know you're frustrated as heck that hasn't been done. But certainly this is a system that is going to you're going to have to look at it. You're going to be able to see it. And there's more accountability in the fact that you're developing a system like this for us to look at that. And I'd like to see that utilized in our policy hearings, at least. And I think there are justifications for investment, too.
Or disinvestment. I think we have to start to get to that point, too, that maybe it isn't necessarily we just continue to throw more resources at the same issue with the same outcomes, but maybe there needs to be disinvestments, or maybe there needs to be a higher level of accountability for if they don't happen. I mean, I think that we can continue to build the tools to say that we're not doing a very good job all we want, but at some point we have to be able to say, well, okay, what happens now that we're not doing a very good job?
That's what I mean, Jeff, when I say, excuse me, Senator, that's what I mean when I say this, that's what a root cause analysis is about. It's to say, hey, the dashboard isn't changing. We need to do a very deep analysis as to where we're misspending our money, what's in the system that's not operating, and it might be that somebody isn't doing their job or somebody's not following through. It typically isn't an individual. It is a system problem that is failed to address and make a change in the benchmark. And, you know, I've been talking about that for state-operated services, for everything. We need to have, instead of excuses, you know, this is what happened wrong this one time. I always use the hospital as my example. You know, we cut off somebody's wrong leg. Oh, we only do that once a year, you know. Well, that's, you know, we've got to change our system to say what do we have to build in the system so we don't cut off the wrong leg. And typically, it's so, more than one person's fault. It's not just the one who took the leg off. There's a whole system of failure in order to have an outcome like that.
Well, and I agree, Madam Chair, and I think Commissioner Jessen, once again, there's some things that are ringing in my mind. I've talked to some folks about that I won't bring to this hearing today. But I'm not very confident that we're I think we're starting on a new journey, and I'm very supportive of it. But I'm not very confident that the work that we're starting to do now is not going to land us in the same place 3 or 4 years from now with healthcare and healthcare access. And so, you know, I won't bring that to this hearing. There's another hearing next week that I'll speak a lot more to that issue. But Commissioner, and we can talk more offline, and I've talked to your folks. I'm not sure we're there. I'm not confident. I'm confident in the ability to track it. I'm confident in your ability to want to do it, but I'm just not sure that sense of urgency and that moving forward, that we're setting up systems that are designed to get people much better outcomes. We're setting them up that fits in the context and the framework of what we have today.
Well, if I could just say something, sure. Senator and others, I think one of the things, this doesn't work if it's just, well, this is a nice tool and it's on the website. But what it works if then you have kind of people that say, in the different administrations, say, how do I make sure we're actually meeting that measure? So, for an example, in our mental health and chemical dependency area, one of the things that they're doing is looking at redoing all their contracts so that then because they do a lot of work through grants and everything, so that all of our outcomes, so that we have clear outcomes in our grants that reflect where we want to go in this, so that our contractors are providing it, or we're not contracting with them anymore. I mean, that's the sort of thing. High level only doesn't matter. It's true unless you push it down. You know, and that's what we're really trying to do. And, you know, I'm as frustrated as anyone that we haven't moved further on disparities. But we're trying to do more than admire the problem here. And to have concrete goals that we're holding people, including all the people that work with us, accountable for doing, to try and move in the right direction.
You know, I get that. You know, the other question here is priorities, right? You know, when you come in a budgetary process, you're establishing priorities of where you're going to spend your time, where you're going to spend your resources, because there's lots of bars, I think, or benchmarks that members of this committee care about: poverty, homelessness. you know, all those benchmarks. What are our initiatives and our expenditures in education in K-12? You know, are we moving the benchmark by how we're spending our money? So there isn't one particular benchmark that that we should be looking at. We have to look at a variety of benchmarks because we're building a budget within the constraints of a budget. How are we going to best utilize our resources? Okay, so I don't want to get into a debate about priorities today or anything. I just want to understand the system that's in place now for change. So, and before I call on you, Senator Kiffmeyer, we are going to take a break for lunch. There's going to be food set out over in the offices over here just out this door. You can go in and prepare your own lunch and bring it back here, and we can continue to meet and eat. I don't know if it's against the rules or not, but I'm going to break them if they are. And
it's not a hearing.
It's not a hearing. That's right. I'll be the one that's accountable, Senator Hayden. You know, the buck stops here. I'll be the one that gets into trouble if that's the case. But if you'll just take maybe 10, 15 minutes to go, take a break, get some food and come back, and then we can continue, if you don't mind, just working and eating at the same time. So with that we're going to probably break in about 10 minutes or so. Is that enough time, do you think?
I can finish in 10 minutes.
Okay, good. But Senator Kiffmeyer has a question here. I want to go back to that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is way too long to even ask here today. Rather, the answer I would expect to be longer. The question isn't that long. I think when I heard you talk about the 25 different housing programs, roughly like that, so for me it was more of a question. If you could say, start over from scratch, because so often we start from what's in current statute, and then we work along those planes. It would be really interesting. You talk about root things. You know, what would you do if you could just start over and start from scratch? Maybe somewhere in your message or in another time. I think I would love to hear your answer to that.
And if I may, Senator, I don't have the answer right now, but that's something we're looking at. And that's why we're bringing people from all those different programs together to say, look, how could we do this better, just if we were doing it from the beginning?
Yeah, and I think the point's been made that it's history is a little cure here, a little cure there, a little cure here to a specific problem creates 23 or 25 different housing programs. And then when we try to dismantle them, as you know, Senator, that particular interest group gets worried that their needs will get lost. You know, there's a special housing program for people with blonde hair and a special housing program for people with blue eyes, you know. And if we integrate that, do any of those special need groups lose out? And that seems to be what I find at the county level to be a struggle. So I'll look forward to our having an integration conversation.
And that's actually a very good lead-in, Senator, to kind of my next section, which is, I think I'm going to skip over this. We've talked about kind of trying to integrate, kind of going from all of the silos that we have, silos that are driven by funding, silos that are sometimes driven by federal law, silos that are kind of because I've done it always this way and I'm protecting my turf. But then one of the reasons we have silos, too, is because of technology, and that kind of is another reason that really drives the complexity. Let me just talk about this for a moment before I kind of go to this. I think many of you all have been around a while know that, you know, the systems that run, it's not like we have one human services system, you know, technology system, and that's what makes it so complicated for county workers, for our folks, and just for people. And that's what we are with our systems modernization money and is kind of building on this miniature platform we're trying to change. But I just want to kind of give you a sense of this because as you think about these things going forward, understanding where we are today and at least what our plan, you know, the roadmap looks like in a very general sense will be helpful to you as I think you think about other policy things. So just to highlight, MMIS, you know, that's a major system. It runs our Medicaid claims payment. It's in COBOL. They don't even teach that in computer programming school anymore. We only manage to keep our system running because we have 70-year-olds that are still working for the department up on our floor, and we're like the aging services, so we're all for that. But I'm not sure that's kind of the path to the future is to just, you know, making sure that it's a system run by 80-year-olds, even though, bless them, they're doing a good job. Maxis, a system that does all of our eligibility programs for cash and food and GRA and GA and a lot of our systems, long outdated. People, once again, designing COBOL. Someone told me, he said, you know, a lot of these systems, you know, they were created when the mouse wasn't even created yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to kind of give you a sense. And then we have a separate system, MEC2, which does all our child care eligibility and management, provider management. PRISM, totally different system that deals with child support. SSIS, a lot of our work with the counties, our child welfare, our foster care, our adoptions, vulnerable adult work, case management through SSIS. I mean, you're kind of getting the sense we have all of these different systems that are all very old. We're having a hard time getting the workforce to even make them run. And when something goes wrong with them, hard to fix them. And hard to make, if you want to move to an integrated system where you're actually doing the best you can instead of all of your different little programs that have grown up over the years, it's hard not only when the programs are complex and set out in legislation and sometimes by federal requirements, but when we have this really complex, antiquated computer system where just to make the two systems talk to each other, you know, is just a huge hurdle where you have to build these one-to-one interfaces, and it's very complex. I know many of you have heard this before, but we are moving, and we are appreciative of the funding opportunities that from the legislative session, and we're trying to kind of build on this platform. You know, kind of when I was talking to the counties about this, I brought my, I don't know if any of y'all have children, but I have four boys, so like Duplos are big in my house, so I brought the big red, or sometimes it's green, kind of one big, you know, platform. And that would be kind of, at least we're trying to move to one platform for this, which is kind of the same thing we're building. We're going to spend all this money. I mean, sure, we're going to build that platform, and then we can start with healthcare, but then we can add different kind of software blocks to that. So we're then adding SNAP, we're adding our, you know, food to that, and then we're adding cash assistance to that, so that when someone goes through the program, ultimately they can go through and find out, are they eligible for, they can check the box, am I eligible for SNAP, am I eligible for MFIP, am I eligible for healthcare, Minnesota Care, instead of having to have one county worker run different eligibility tests through five or six different programs. We think in the long term, this is going to be better for, you know, more administrative, you know, simplification, better for people. And we want to make it more user-friendly so that the county workers can be working with individuals using kind of a case management system that's people-centered instead of having these five or six different systems. I think in the next slide, it kind of gives you a sense of where, when we think those different parts kind of can be built in. This is hard to see, but I think the point, reason I put it up there, and this is a work in progress, you know, this is, and that's why it says draft on it, but it'll tell you that we think if we build it this kind of new system kind of on this platform for healthcare, then we can pretty quickly add SNAP. But it's going to take longer to add child support because that's the whole PRISM system and our child care parts. So it's really going to be something we're going to have to kind of be a work in progress over the next, you know, 4 years probably. And during that time, it's going to be a challenge for, especially I think for county workers and people, because they'll be on two systems. One, the one we're trying to get everything on, but in the meantime, for people, they're going to have to be using some of the old systems as well. So it's a challenge to, when you're talking about an integrated, person-centered human services system, but it's also its real opportunity, I think, and paid for with. And we're trying to maximize federal funding to do this, to do part of this as well. So I just wanted to have that out there because I think when you talk to the different administrations, you know, and they come up and talk to you about their part of the department, you'll hear about some of the challenges with technology. So that's why I just wanted to kind of say, this is one of those challenges, and we are trying to have a roadmap for it. You know, Madam Chair, my last few slides were just about the budget. I can, very high level, just, you know, maybe I could just do one slide on those, and then we could be done. Does that make sense? Because I think most of you all know a lot of this. But let's just take a look at, you know, now that we've kind of gone through at a very high level all of these different programs, what constitutes the how much do they make up of the DHS budget? And these are the direct appropriations from the legislature, obviously. So, you know, we also have federal funds to look at here. But you'll see, as we were talking about earlier, if you look at the combination of Minnesota Care and Medicaid and MA, that's about 80% of the dollars. And forecasted other programs, when you see that on there, which is about 9%, that's our MFIT program and a lot of our other economic assistance programs too. you know, our GA program, our alternative care program for the elderly, and that also includes our chemical dependency treatment fund programming. And so that's about 9%. And grant programs, those are ones that aren't entitlements in any way, but that includes child care and child support, refugee services, we do a lot of that. You know, a lot of our mental health work we do is through grant programs. You know, I'll point out, like, state-operated services, even though, just to kind of come back to one of the things we started, even though it's more than half our employees and a number of our challenges, it is 2.9% of our budget, which is, I think, sometimes why, you know, that's something that doesn't always come to the forefront, and I'm really as much as it should, and I'm so appreciative of your holding a hearing just on that. Our sex offender treatment program, once again, high-profile issue, about 1% of our budget. So I think you'll hear more about the different administrations, about what parts they have in their budget and how their parts are funded, how much in grant dollars, how much in federal dollars. And they'll go through that kind of on an administration-by-administration basis, but I at least wanted you to leave with an overall, you know, take on you know, how the money flows through the department.
Commissioner, when you say forecasted programs, this might be oversimplifying it, but based on our existing policies about eligibility, et cetera, the department projects the amount of utilization and that the budget is established on that. So the way you change any of these pies, shapes, might be in changing those eligibility requirements, right? Within the law, within what's all, allowed at the federal government.
Correct. I mean, yeah. It's driven by the benefit levels and, you know, and who's eligible for those benefits. So you look at both of those. And so then, so the forecast, if the economic times are worse, we know more people will probably turn to Medicaid. So you end up with forecast of that program going up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the differences, it takes some time. So for new members, just thinking about forecast versus unforecast, some examples are often helpful. I mean, like the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is not forecast. If we were forecasting it, we would do growth estimates and say how much it would cost. Instead, it's just a budget allocation that is a dollar amount. And if we want to meet the budget that it's going to take to fund that program to accommodate the growth that does tend to occur, we have to specifically allocate that, but you won't find it in our budget forecast documents. Adoption assistance has never been a forecasted program, but certainly the adoption assistance roles change over time in ways that are predictable, but we have to continually come back and update them on the sheet. So, I mean, these are, you know, Medicaid is a forecasted program, Minnesota Care is a forecasted program, there's a couple of others, but then some of these programs are not forecasted, and you'll just see a budget number on a sheet, and that's what winds up in our budget, and then we have to make a specific legislative action to account for changes that occur within these programs, and so some that just helps understand.
Commissioner, you were going to say, or Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a follow-up question. Senator Laurie, that is very helpful. And my follow-up question is who decides the different, who decides and what is a forecasted program and what is a budget program? And do we have particular guidelines that help us determine that?
No, the legislature determines whether any given program is forecast or not. And if it's forecasted, then it's then the departments go ahead and do the projections. MMB oversees them and takes a look at them, and then we get new budget forecasts out of MMB that indicate, you know, what our anticipated next biennial budget is going to look like, and updates on the existing budget and things like that. But it's all, to the best of my knowledge, it's all set in statute. And we, you know, I don't know of any guidelines that we use.
Do you want to respond to that at all before I go back to Senator?
go ahead, Senator.
And just another follow-up, just to try and get a better understanding of all of this. So would it be accurate to say that it is the oftentimes, not always, but in general, the growth in the forecasted programs that often leads then to a projected budget deficit? So in other words, when we leave here, the budget is balanced. As the new budget cycle starts, sometimes there's a deficit, and yet there had been a balanced budget. And so I'm just assuming that it's the growth in the forecasted programs that often leads to that projected budget deficit. Not always, but is that an accurate assumption?
It can be, and that's why we come back in and change the parameters or the assumptions upon which that forecast was made. And if you change those assumptions, then the forecast changes.
Yes.
The financial analysis has changed because we're proposing putting something in law. Then they do the financial analysis and send us that fiscal note that we all fight about. Mm-hmm. And there may be more complexity to it than that. But there's also the, like, state-operated sex offenders program. They can't anticipate how many more are going to come in. The counties are the ones that do the civil commitment process. And so we've never put that in a forecasted program. But we've had the department come back and say they've had cost overruns in non-forecasted programs. Or they can have there can be an under utilization of what we've expended. And then that money just goes back into the general fund if it's unexpended, is my understanding what happens. Commissioner, and then Senator Lori wants to address it again.
Maybe I could give one example of something we did in 2011, I think, that dealt with some of these issues. Just dealing with one of our fastest growing programs is our managed care programs, which was kind of one of those things I was learning. So they come in and, you know, they just, you know, they make assumptions for a variety of reasons that you have to give increases to managed care companies that run our managed care programs, but we don't make assumptions that you increase the fee for service. Right, so that's something the legislature has to come in and, you know, so that's not built into the forecast, fee-for-service rates increases, while we build into the forecast increases to managed care companies. One of the things that we did in 2011 was say we're going to actually put some caps on that to try and, you know, hold down growth in those programs so that if there's more spending where you do have to spend more than 2% and then 3%, and as opposed to the projected, I think, 6% increases a year, then you're going to have to come back to the legislature and get that permission, which is something that, you know, I very much supported and I think has helped us, you know, just to try and drive down in some of those areas. So I think there are some things that we can – that's an example of something the legislature did in a forecasted program to try and, I think, send a message and drive down long-term costs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think that's true. And the what I wanted to add is that the distinction between forecasted and non-forecasted is not unique to Health and Human Services. It's across all our budget jurisdictions and including our revenue side, too. So, I mean, when we draw forecasts, it's the entire balance. That's the work of MMB, is to decide, you know, what it is. And so, you know, coming back, there's been discussions about, let's go to the sex offender program and just talk about some pros and cons. I mean, people have talked to me many times about, well, we should just make that a forecast program. The thing's been growing. And I said, you know what? I personally don't want it forecast because I want us to come and take a look at this each and every year. And because it really needs some drastic attention. Minnesota Care, Medicaid, based on the economic status of a family, I think it would be disastrous if we allowed our budget to run without forecasting these programs to see, you know, I mean, we set thresholds for very specific reasons. Families are really in need at certain thresholds, and if we're going into an economic downturn, we need to accommodate for that and be able to make sure that we put together a package that works for Minnesotans. And so we have to balance those, but that's kind of a little bit of the dynamic behind when we make these decisions.
Yeah, once we've determined the level of need that we're going to use an intervention at, we need to know if we keep that in place, what it's going to cost us in order to continue to support a group at that level of poverty. Mm-hmm. And then we argue about where else is it going to come from, or do we need to change an assumption? You had a follow-up question,
well,
Senator?
Just I just want to know more, actually, looking at this and looking at how we compare to other states as far as forecast programs and not forecast programs. And so it's just something for another day to look into the difference, and is there a better way to do it? I'm not sure. And so just
It's something that we've Madam Chair, it's something we've looked at a lot of times. I mean, I know one thing that Minnesota does not forecast that every other state in the country does, and that's inflation. You know, I mean, there's about $1 billion of inflation that we pretty much know. I mean, and everybody who runs a private business knows you got to accommodate for higher fuel prices, higher, you know, just things that tend to grow. And we've had this discussion many, many times, and you know, a few years ago, we decided to take that off of our books and take it out of the forecast. We're unique in that position, but that it is something that we do spend a great deal of time talking about.
One of the frustrations I have sometimes, I mean, I'd love to have just a non-hearing conversation, you know, a roundabout discussion of the implications of having something forecast and not forecasted, like inflation is one of many. Just to have that as a sort of a conversational debate. The only way we do it in the legislature is if somebody puts a proposal in front of us to count inflation in the forecasted programs, and then we all argue about that particular thing. And then another bill comes forward to say, let's take this out of a forecast and put it in now we debate about that. But we never get a chance like this to sit around and talk about what's the reasoning and the rationale and the general overall conversation we ought to have around this concept. And I hope we do more of that. I'm learning from this, and I think there's lots more, you know, that Senator Lori's teaching us about what he knows about these forecast programs. So is there something further we need? I want to take advantage. I want you're here. I want to take advantage of you a little bit. And
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much. This opportunity, there are a few other slides. You can look at those. And let us know if, after hearing from Children and Families, you'd like to hear this information from administrations in a different way. You know, if there are questions at the end of this series or in the middle you'd like to ask me about, happy to come back.
I appreciate we will invite you back, I'm sure. And I hope before our day is over today to get to ask everybody what they'd like to get from an orientation like this, so we, in our future planning, that we're able to go where people would like to learn. And with that, I would like to invite you, Commissioner. We have some lunch prepared for everybody over in the office. If you go out this door, you make your own plate, right? And then come on back in here, and we'll recess and get back in about 20 minutes and pick up. And you can still be eating, and we'll continue with the rest.